This is Cade Massey, practice professor at the Wharton School. On this week's Wharton Moneyball Highlight Show, we have an interview with Mark Brody, Columbia University professor and creator of Strokes Gained, the most important new statistic in golf in the last 20 years, really revolutionized golf analytics. He's been involved with the game now intimately for decades and terrific person to talk to as we roll into Masters Week. This is Mark Brody.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. This is Cade Massey hosting today with the whole crew. Shane Jensen is here. Eric Bradlow is here. Audie Weiner is here. We're coming to you via Zoom as we usually are these days. And also here, Mark Brody, longtime friend of the show, frequent guest of the show, Columbia Business School professor, re-engineering the game of golf, or at least the coverage and analysis, and hence, eventually, to some extent, the game itself, author of a book called Every Shot Counts. Mark Brody, living the dream of many analysts out there, joining us, I believe, from New York City. Mark, afternoon to you.
Thanks for having me, Cade, and nice to see you, Shane, Adi, Eric. Great to be on here again.
Thanks, man. I think the last time we saw you, certainly the last time we saw you in person, was last year's MIT Sloan Conference. We had a chance, Shane and I sat down with you for a good little stretch, had a fun conversation. You guys can track that down online if you want 2023 version of the conversation. But Mark, we're always happy to talk to you, but we tracked you down this week because it's Masters Week. This arguably is the biggest week in the annual golf year. Maybe only the Ryder Cup every other year rivals Masters in terms of popularity. How are you thinking about it? How are you consuming it? How are you analyzing it? What is the Masters, the 2024 Masters in particular, to you?
Well, majors are, you know, four of the biggest events every year. So there's a lot of eyeballs. And this being the first major of the year, like you said, it just generates the most viewership and interest among casual golf fans. So there's a lot of casual golf fans and non-golf fans that don't pay attention to golf most of the year. If they watch one tournament, it's usually the Masters. And so I think there's a lot of reasons for that besides its major, besides the history. It has a small field guaranteed to produce great leaderboards every year because all the players are either great players, household names, stars, some, you know, up and coming stars, or a little bit of the non-contenders, the older champions, some of the amateurs that don't really have a chance. So the effective field size is even smaller when you realize that those players are nice to have, but they're not going to win.
Well, right? Hold on. You say that, but then 1986 in my college dorm room, as we woke up after a late night, we watched the 40-something-year-old Jack Nicklaus winning the Masters completely unexpectedly, right? And we've had more examples since then. It's just the most illustrious of them.
That I would not say is an example of somebody who you did not expect to win. I was thinking of the other players that are, you know, beyond 50,
winning,
say,
the Masters.
Okay. I don't think Mike Weir is going to win the Masters, for example.
That's true. Mike's not going to win the Canadian Open, sadly, but he's kind of disappeared from competition recently. So just to fix ideas, we say this about the PGA every year because it more often than others produces champions that people don't know. And it's a field size thing. And you're saying one of the reasons we like Sunday in Augusta is a field size thing. This is one of those great boring explanations. Always start with the most boring explanation, right? Field size is going to explain a lot. So tell us exactly what the field sizes are roughly. I know they vary some across the four majors.
So it's this year varies a little bit year to year. It's 89 at the Masters.
Yep.
The Players Championship is a full field and it has, I don't know, 144 players. But I think most of the majors have at least 140 players. And the U.S. Open is known for scheduling the Sunday finale on Father's Day. Why is that not to honor the fathers? It's the longest day of the year. And so right around then, you can have the most players in an event because you have the most daylight in an event. So I think the US Open has over 150 players, and they can squeeze it in on the longest day of the year or around that, but not necessarily in the fall.
Mark, before we move on, this is a small question, but like the US Open doing it's kind of over that playoff format where they come back the next day and play a full 18 holes. Is that at all linked to this sort of dynamic, or is it does it predate that?
No, I think that playoff format is gone. It used to be there, but they no longer have the 18 hole next day playoff that, you know, people are back at work and nobody had a chance to watch. And so they've all changed their playoff formats. The Open Championship, formerly known as the British Open, has a three or five hole playoff.
Yeah, three hole.
Yeah. Which to me seems kind of reasonable. Instead of tossing a coin, you at least get a few more holes, but not 18 the next day.
The thing that's also to me wonderful about the Masters, as you know, Mark, is that 50 and ties make the cut. So it's 50 out of 89. So I agree with you, Mike Weir, Vijay Singh, Fred Couples. If he hadn't torn his Achilles, Bernard Langer, they're not winning the Masters. But if you tell me Mike Weir makes the cut, Mike Weir could make the cut at the Masters. Vijay Singh could make the cut at the Masters. Absolutely, they could. And that's also part of the lore of the tournament is that, you know, do these grand champions play on Saturday and Sunday?
And it's so interesting to watch exactly that because you want to see kind of comparing the old generation to the new generation and seeing Bernard Langer competing year after year, sometimes, you know, in the top 10 going into Sunday is a great draw because it brings in old fans and new fans. So even if they can't win, exactly like you said, Eric, it is incredible for popularity of the event.
So, you know, Mark, you're talking about these old timers. Tell me a little bit about the age curve in golf. We were discussing it in our last show in some of the other sports. Some of them are just immediately negative. They start from the time you enter and just go down. We were talking about esports, where I think it peaks at 17, and from then on, it's down. And I'm wondering, but golf seems like there's some value to being, you know, older. You lose a little strength, but how much does that matter? And really, I mean, why is it so impossible for a 45-year-old or even a 50-year-old?
It's not. Mickelson won the PGA, but Mark's going to talk about.
Yeah, but what are the relative odds? I would guess.
So I think if you look at averages. Golf has this inverted U where typically younger players get better, they learn the courses, they mature, and so their scores or their finishes improve for a few years. And then sometime after 30 is typically a long, slow decline, and you have to take into account survivorship bias because the ones that stay on that old are the ones that can compete, whereas most of them are falling off. So if you actually wanted to do a statistical analysis, taking into account survivorship biases is key. And then there are the exceptions. And the exception would be somebody like Phil Mickelson, whose curve declined much, much slower. Tiger Woods' curve has declined, you know, when he's played much, much, much slower. So there's definitely outliers there. And the curve is just giving you an average, but saying that, yes, things will decline. But you also have the interesting stories of somebody like Padraig Harrington, who's playing on the Champions Tour and PGA Tour events and DP World Tour events, and is driving it as long now, post 50, as he was as a younger player.
Look, Mark, we also all remember, you know, this is the dream of every golfer, right? We also remember the 7-footer that Tom Watson missed at age 58 or 59 at the British Open that would have won him the British Open in his almost 60 years old. And so trust me, if you're playing the mental game, the Vijay Singhs, the Phil Mickelsons, the Tiger Woods is saying, if Tom Watson can do it, why can't I do it? And I can do it at the Masters. Why not at the Masters, where experience plays a role?
So one of the things that comes into play there is course fit. And the British Open playing on a links-style course is a place where experience has the biggest advantage and where length may have the smallest advantage. So it wasn't necessarily that Tom Watson could win any tournaments. It's that he had a unique relative advantage at a links style British Open course. So that makes that
great
possible.
Point.
So let's
might not
step back
be
and talk about Augusta and the Masters. As you think about, so you model golfers, of course, and you want to try to forecast golf performance. What goes into that, and what goes into it at the Masters that might be different than it does in other tournaments?
So what goes into, you know, predicting success at an event, whether success is winning or top five or top 10 or just playing better than average? I think there are so many factors, and that's what makes it interesting. When you read all of the prognostications about the Masters, somebody will point to, well, who's done the best in the last year? Who's done the best in the past four events? Who did or did not make the cut last week? So there's a question of how do you measure performance, what time period, and how do you combine those together? But then there's course fit and course history, and those are not quite the same thing. Course fit is players have different strengths and weaknesses. What of those play into Augusta National? Course history is beyond that. What does a player learn about a course from playing it over and over? And you could add on to that so many things. Does driving distance, is that more favored at Augusta than other players at other courses? High ball flights. You know, golf has this contradiction where wedge shots, you want to hit low trajectory with spin. Long iron shots, you want to hit high so that they land vertically and can stop on these very difficult green. So high ball flight. Augusta is known as a second shot course, which I don't necessarily think the data bears that out, but some people will overweight approach play. Augusta is the hardest course to putt. If you look at the three putt rate, it is the highest on tour. So maybe putting is most important. There's an article that came out by Justin Ray a couple of days ago about.
Can I interrupt you for a second? And how should we think about just that last observation you made about it, because you said this is definitively true, at least as measured by three putts. Augusta is the toughest putting course. And so therefore putting matters more, therefore putting matters less. And so how does it work? Is it like that separates the men from the boys, if you will, or that kind of crushes everybody? It's all luck.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I was leading to. You have all these different factors. People will point to different ones to buttress their argument why this player is more likely to win. But putting is an interesting case at Augusta. It does have more three putts, but it's also easier to putt from close range. Inside of 10 feet, more putts are made at Augusta than at other courses.
What, okay, is that because it's just truer greens? They're putting on glass? And so is that the explanation?
Yes.
Interesting.
And that's kind of surprising. The putting kind of cuts both ways. It's easier to sink five footers at Augusta than it is at Pebble Beach or any other course because the greens are so perfect and true.
Well, that's an amazing testament to how good they are. That the greens at these tournaments, I mean, best courses in the world, in the best condition of the year, and you're saying one stands above the other, just as revealed in how makeable a 10-foot putt is. That's remarkable and really speaks to what's different down there. That's so interesting.
Yet the three-putt rate is higher, and that's because when you get outside of 15 feet or so, with the fast greens and the very severe slopes, it's hard to get it close to the hole. So even if you make more five-footers at that course, you have more of them for second putts.
Okay. Now, Mark, I've heard you pose this kind of trivia question, if you will, this classic golf nerdy trivia question, but I haven't heard the answer, and I want to speculate. I want to hear the guys speculate. What's easier? This is all golf courses, right? This isn't just Augusta. A 10-foot uphill putt, or was it 8 foot? 8 foot uphill
eight
putt,
foot.
A 6 foot side hill putt. So the guys, let's see what folks think. I had this strong intuition that, you know, it's like one of these things where, well, if Mark's asking the question, then it must be surprising. And so maybe that side hill putt's the right answer. But I can't get past the intuition that I really want the 8 foot uphill putt. Audie.
I have no idea, and this is the kind of question that I would refer to the actual golfers. But my question to you, Mark, is can you measure that in the data? Do you think you have good enough data to answer that question?
absolutely have good data. And that's what I was kind of leading toward. With data, you can answer this question. Without data, you could
What do the
argue
experts say?
endlessly.
Well, you wouldn't argue endlessly if they all kind of agree. I guess as a an effect size guy, right, Eric? I would argue that if it's a pretty big effect, the players probably know it. And if it's not such a big effect, then they might argue about it. Then it's nice to know, but it's not that big. What is it? Where does it come
I
down?
have a guess, but I do
Yeah.
you want me to state my guess? It depends on. I assume you mean a straight 8 foot putt, Mark, relatively straight.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm going to get this wrong. I think I'd rather have a straight uphill 8 foot putt all day long than if it's,
Okay.
I don't know if you said downhill, but side hill. Down, I mean,
That
yeah, whatever. I'm taking the straight uphill 8 footer all day long.
James?
Yeah, as a very, very amateur golfer who never seemed to get the weight right and always put too much weight on my putts, I'll take the uphill one. I'll take an 8 foot uphill putt over a 3 foot downhill putt.
He said 6 foot side hill.
Yeah.
Six
Yeah.
no, 3 foot. I'm going to take the
I was
3 footer.
just exaggerating for to make,
What's
yeah.
the answer, Mark? What's the actual answer?
So it is counterintuitive, and the question is one of effect size, like you said, because straighter putts, uphill putts are easier than side hill putts. Everybody agrees on that. 6 foot putts are generally easier than 8 foot putts. Everybody agrees on the distance effect. Everybody agrees on the break effect. So the question is, which is more important? And distance trumps break. The 6 foot side hill putt is made at a greater rate than an 8 foot uphill putt. Part of the reason for that is when it's 8 foot, you don't know if it's straight uphill exactly. It could be uphill and a slight right to left, uphill, a slight left to right. So it's not like somebody is telling you and giving you an 8 foot putt and saying, aim straight at the hole because it will go in. You
Just
still have to
last
do the
to
green reading and figure that out. And 2 feet, the make rate drops off so fast from 8 feet to 6 feet and from 6 feet to 4 feet that distance trumps break all the time.
Super interesting. Super interesting. Okay, let's stay with putting for a moment. And so there's two things that are interesting here. One is I know you've thought about this and you work with it in your models, and it's this interesting observation that people have made in recent years. And in fact, Audie's worked on this as well. That putting is fantastic tool for describing who won a tournament, and a terrible tool for predicting who's gonna win a tournament. So it makes a big difference in outcomes, but it's hugely difficult to replicate. Doesn't replicate out of sample very well. So what does that mean for what you do? And then what does it mean for one of the best golfers in the world right now, Scottie Scheffler, who's famously, by statistics, the best ball striker in the world right now, but suffers on the putting green. He's had a little bit of progress lately, and then he goes and flubs like a 5 footer to win a tournament or to tie in a tournament. How do you think about putting, and what does it mean for how we should forecast Scheffler's performance?
Well, I think it's an interesting general question. What makes a good stat in sports?
Yep.
And one is that it's highly correlated with the outcome. So what leads to winning? What leads to scoring runs, or what leads to a lower score in golf? So you want something that is tightly connected to the outcome. So that's one good metric for a stat. And the other is that it's repeatable, that you can actually predict the player's putting performance. And it turns out that putting performance is highly variable week to week. So when a player wins a tournament and you look back on what did they do, they typically putted great. But in advance of the event, you can't predict who's going to putt great. Whereas in advance of an event, you can predict who's going to drive the ball longer. And we know that longer drives are correlated a little bit less so, but they're correlated with winning. Whereas driving distance, you can predict week to week. Putting performance, you cannot. So even though it's highly correlated with the outcome, it's not necessarily what bettors would use. And so if you take a look at a player, what a lot of bettors do is they look at how well do they play tee to green, and then they almost subtract out or downweight putting because that's so variable week to week. So Scottie Scheffler is an example. If you take a look at the top 10 in the official World Golf Rankings or some other ranking, they are all elite ball strikers. And most of them are slightly above average putters. it's the exception of a top 10 player who's a great putter and not such a good ball striker. But Scottie Scheffler is emblematic of superior, elite, world-class ball striking. And when he putts well enough, he wins.
Okay, before you go, you got to give us a golfer or two to pay attention to this weekend. And obviously, we're interested in somebody not named Rory or Scotty. Who do you like better than the markets, or who do you have your eye on this weekend?
So you already mentioned him, Ludvig Åberg, I think. Is somebody that doesn't have the history. He's a first timer at Augusta, but I think that misses that he's got a great caddy. So his caddy, Joe Skavron, used to caddy for Ricky Fowler and most recently Tom Kim. So he knows Augusta like the back of his hand. And so I think this not having known the course is somewhat mitigated by having a great caddy. So he's one that I would say an off the radar kind of pick.
Good. Okay.
The other one, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable here because he has a reputation of not being a closer, and that's Xander Schauffele.
Yep.
So I think he's undervalued by the market because he has this reputation, and somebody's going to, you know, Tony Finau had that reputation for quite a while. He has a chance to break out of that. So, of course, neither of these players has anywhere near Scottie Scheffler's chance of winning, but as far as under the radar, positive expected value bets, I'd mention Åberg and Schauffele.
And I'll put my stake in the sand, if they call it stake, whatever it is called. The man from Japan, Hideki Matsuyama, is playing extremely well right now. I like his chances. If I had to pick someone that's a little bit down there in that range, I'm going with Hideki.
Speaking of that, and one last bit, I want to throw Eric a bone because we always give him a hard time about liking momentum more than he should. He gets pulled into these intuitive psychological bits, but golf forecasting is a place where momentum actually matters, is my understanding. Mark, you run the models. How true is that? How much can he just said Matsuyama's playing real well right now. Usually I want to scoff when Eric says things like that. In this case, I think he's probably got something to put some chips on. How do you represent it, Mark?
I believe in Eric. I believe in Rufus Peabody. I believe in the numbers that I've looked, and momentum is a thing in golf for sure. It's not like streaky hot hand. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about like Nelly Korda. Is that going to increase your chance of winning the next event? We're not talking about that. We're talking about, does a player who plays incredibly well one week have an above average chance of playing quite well the next week? And I think it is a real effect. The question is, how much do you want to weight it?
Yeah, it goes back to weight.
That's a tougher question.
this is your modeler's questions. How much weights? Okay, Mark, on the way out, tell people where they can find you, especially this weekend while we're watching the Masters. Where can we be following your thoughts on the Masters?
On Twitter, now X, at Mark Brody, MarkBroadie, is where I occasionally post some of these kind of thoughts.
Okay, great. All right, Mark, thanks for making time for us. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Mark Brody, Columbia University professor, innovator in the world of golf. He's the creator of Strokes Gained, which has revolutionized analytics in golf, as you guys know, over the last, I don't know, 15 years or so. Long time friend of the show. Always a pleasure. Thank you guys for being here. On behalf of the whole team, Audie Weiner, Eric Bradlow, Shane Jensen, for Maddie Datz, the boss man, for Dion Simpkins, the associate boss man, for Kelly, the intern, appreciate y'all listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.